A liberator creates space for people to step up, while a tyrant swings between positions and creates whiplash in the organization. A liberator builds stability that generates forward momentum. The liberator. The liberator creates an environment where good things happen. They create the conditions where intelligence is engaged, grown, and transformed into concrete successes. What are the conditions for this cycle of learning and success? They might include: ideas are generated with ease. People learn rapidly and adapt to new environments. People work collaboratively. Complex problems get solved, and difficult tasks get accomplished. Let's examine three liberators from very different industries who created these conditions and freed their organizations to think and to perform. Liberator number one, equity in the firm. Ernest Bacharach from Argentina is the director and special partner for Advent International, a global private equity firm. With 27 years of experience in international private equity and an MBA from Harvard University, Ernest is clearly an expert. But the source of his genius is the environment he creates to unleash the genius of his organization. One of his analysts described his approach. Ernest makes a conscious effort to create an environment. He creates forums for people to voice their ideas, but he holds a very high bar for what you must do before you voice an opinion. You need to have the data. He has a problem with opinions without data. Ernest builds a learning machine in his organization. When he discovers performance problems, he's quick to give feedback. The feedback is direct and sometimes harsh, but he dispenses the feedback in small enough doses that someone can absorb it, learn from it, and adjust. He teaches his organization that mistakes are a way of life in the investment business. And how does he respond to mistakes? First, he doesn't panic or assign arbitrary blame. One team member said, "He lets us know that when decisions are collective, the mistakes are collective too. No one person takes the blame." The team then does a postmortem and learns how to avoid the error a second time. It appears that Ernest understands how to create an environment that best leverages the investments he's made in his people. Liberator number two, close encounters. Everyone knows Steven Spielberg as an award-winning film director, and it's likely that your list of top 10 movies includes one of his films. But why are his movies so successful? Grossing an average of $156 million per film. Some would posit that it is his creative genius and his ability to tell a story. Others would point to his work ethic. But the true active ingredient may be his ability to elicit more from his crew than other directors do. People who have worked on Spielberg's films say you do your best work around him. One way he elicits the best thinking from people is that he knows what people are actually capable of producing. Though he knows everyone's jobs intimately, he doesn't do it for them. He tells them that he's hired them because he admires their work. He uses his knowledge of the job and their personal capabilities to set a standard for demanding their best efforts. He comes with strong ideas of his own, but he makes it clear that bad ideas are an okay starting point. He says, all good ideas start as bad ideas. That's why it takes so long. He establishes an open, creative environment, but still demands extraordinary work from his team. One of his crew members said, he expects people to be doing their best, and you know it when you are not giving your best. And why does Spielberg produce so many successful movies? Because his crew is twice as productive as those of some of the tyrant directors we studied. Because Spielberg creates an environment where people can do their best work, these artists and staff sign up to work with him again and again. In fact, Spielberg typically manages two projects simultaneously, each in different production stages, because his crew stays with him and rolls directly onto the next project. He gets their best work and two times the productivity. and they get to create award-winning films along with him. Liberator number 3, a master teacher. Stop and think about the best teachers you've had. Pause for a moment and identify one or two. What type of learning environment did they create? How much space and freedom of thought did you have? What were the expectations of your performance? In what ways were you stretched and utilized? And how did you actually perform? I asked these questions of a dozen eighth grade students in Mr. Kelly's class. Patrick Kelly teaches U.S. history and social studies to eighth graders at a distinguished California public school. He caught my attention when I learned that every year at middle school graduation ceremony, he not only gets more shout-outs and thank yous from the graduating students than any other teacher, he gets more than all the other teachers combined. He is more talked about, more loathed, more beloved than any other teacher at the school. Why? I got my first glimpse at the fall parent information night at La Entrada Middle School. It is one of those nights parents with multiple children dread because with 4 children, I have to get to 17 different teachers' classes, many simultaneously defying the laws of physics. My daughter in 8th grade said to me, "Here's my class schedule. Go to as many classes as you can, but be sure to make it to Mr. Kelly's social studies class. And do not be late. And do not talk during his presentation, and do not answer your cell phone, and do not be late. Mom, did you hear me about not being late?" I entered his classroom both scared and intrigued. After the standard 12-minute segment with Mr. Kelly, I left enchanted with 8th grade social studies, ready to quit my job and go back to middle school to learn U.S. history. How does he affect students and parents alike in such powerful ways? It begins with his classroom environment. He makes it clear that you are there to work hard, to think, and to learn. One student said, in his class, he doesn't tolerate laziness. You're always working, thinking things over, and seeing your mistakes so you can learn from them. It's a professional and serious environment, which gets lighter and more fun as the students work harder. In this environment, students are encouraged to speak up and voice their opinions. Equal weight is given to asking a good question and to answering one of his. Mr. Kelly's expectations for the students' learning are both clear and extremely high. One student said, he believes that with high expectations comes high results. He demands our best. He makes it clear that if we put in our hardest effort, we will succeed. Another said, he doesn't hide anything from us and lets us know what to improve on. He demands that we work to the best of our ability. No more. No less, just to the best of their ability. There's no homework in his class, nothing assigned, nothing arbitrary. Instead, students are encouraged to do what he calls independent study, to help them understand the ideas and perform well on tests. The students, having made the choice themselves, do the independent study with zeal. Not all students like Mr. Kelly. Some find him too tough, too demanding, and his expectations unfair compared to other teachers. For students wanting the easy path, his class can be an uncomfortable environment. But most students are engaged by his intelligence and his dedication and thrive under his leadership. They experience his contagious passion and themselves become passionate about civil rights, the U.S. Constitution, and their role in the political process. Patrick Kelly is a multiplier who liberates his students to think and learn. He creates an environment where students can speak out, but where they are required to think and perform at their finest. It won't surprise you that 98% of students in his class score at the proficient or advanced levels on standardized state tests, up from 82% just 3 years previously. A hybrid climate. The secret behind the environment in Mr. Kelly's classroom and Ernest Bachrach's firm and Steven Spielberg's movie sets is in the duality we consistently found these liberators embraced. They appear to hold two ostensibly opposing positions with equal fervor. They create both comfort and pressure in the environment. In the eyes of the liberator, it's a just exchange. I give you space. You give me back your best work. Liberators also give people space to make mistakes. They create an environment of learning, but they expect people to learn from the mistakes. Another fair trade. I give you permission to make mistakes. You have an obligation to learn from the mistakes and not repeat them. The power of liberators emanates from this duality. It isn't enough just to free people's thinking. They create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and their best work. They generate pressure, but they don't generate stress. Liberators operate with this dual operating system, much like a hybrid car that switches over seamlessly between the electric and the gasoline engine. At low speeds, a hybrid operates in electric mode. At high speeds, it draws on gasoline to fuel the extra demands on the engine. Such leaders create an open, comfortable environment where people can freely think and contribute. And when more power is needed, they invoke their demanding side that commands only the best performance from others. How do liberators create a safe, open environment and also relentlessly demand the best thinking and work of those around them? How do they get the full brain power of the organization? Let's turn to the practices of the liberator for answers. The three practices of the liberator. Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found three common practices. Liberators, number one, create space. Number two, demand people's best work. And number three, generate rapid learning cycles. We'll examine each in turn. Practice number one, create space. Everyone needs space. We need space to contribute and to work. Liberators don't take it for granted that people have the space they need. They deliberately carve out space for others to be able to make a contribution. Let's look at some examples of how they do this. Release others by restraining yourself. It is a small victory to create space for others to contribute. It is a huge victory to maintain that space and resist the temptation to jump back in and consume it yourself. This is especially true in formal, hierarchical organizations where people are accustomed to deferring to their leaders. Ray Lane, former president of Oracle Corporation and a prominent Silicon Valley venture capitalist, is a master at executive restraint. One of his portfolio CEOs remarked, "Ray has learned the importance of restraint in leadership. He knows that less is more, and he never wastes an opinion." When Ray goes on sales calls to meet with executives at a potential client's, two things are certain. One, the client will want to hear from Ray and his vast experience. And two, Ray will be prepared. But despite these forces pulling him in, he holds back. He offers a few opening pleasantries, but he lets the sales team do the deal. Issues come up in conversation that Ray has a point of view about, but still, he waits. The sales team, knowing full well that Ray could probably be doing a better job than they, continues their work nonetheless. When they're done, Ray then comes into the conversation. He still doesn't unleash his ideas and give a monologue. He has listened carefully and knows exactly what he wants to add. He dispenses his views in small but intense doses. A longtime colleague of Ray remarked, "He'll often be quiet for long stretches of an important meeting. He listens to what others are saying, and when he does speak, everyone listens." Ray is well known as a brilliant strategist and is perhaps one of the most articulate communicators in his business. But instead of overplaying himself and his own ideas, he creates room for others and uses his presence where it can have the greatest potency and impact for the team. Shift the ratio of listening to talking. Liberators are more than just good listeners. They are ferocious listeners. They listen to feed their hunger for knowledge, to learn what other people know and add it to their own reservoir of knowledge. As the late management guru C.K. Prahalad once said to me, how smart you are is defined by how clearly you can see the intellect of others. They listen intently because they're trying to learn and understand what other people know. John Brandon, one of Apple Inc.'s top sales executives, runs an organization that brings in tens of billions of dollars in revenue each year across three regions of the world. John is a high-energy sales leader and maintains an aggressive travel and meeting schedule, so getting time on his calendar can be tough. But when his direct reports meet with him one-on-one, they get his whole presence. John listens intently to them and is keenly interested in understanding their reality. What is really happening on the ground with customers and with deals? He asks probing questions that get to the heart of the matter. One of his direct reports said, "The difference with John is not that he listens, it is that he listens to an extreme." In a typical conversation, he spends 80% of the time listening and asking questions. By listening, asking, and probing, John develops an understanding of the realities of the business and an understanding with his team of the opportunities and problems they face. This collective insight into the market has enabled John's organization to experience a phenomenal 375% growth over the last 5 years. John, who can certainly talk a good game himself, knows when it's time to listen. Liberators don't just listen a lot of the time, they listen most of the time, massively shifting the ratio and creating space for others to share what they know. Define a space for discovery. John Hoke, Nike Inc.'s chief of global design, gathered his senior leaders for a week offsite to explore new thinking in design and how leaders can multiply the talent inside their organization, which I helped facilitate. He wasn't expecting to hear that his optimism as a leader was a problem, but he quickly realized that his hopeful style of leadership might be causing some angst. His team explained the extraordinary pressure they felt to deliver flawless design every time. With the Olympics around the corner and a brand promise to sustain, the group insisted that there was simply no room to fail. With John's encouragement, his team and I decided to define a space for experimentation. We rapidly laid out their various work scenarios into two buckets. In one, failure was okay. In the other, success had to be assured. The group debated each until they agreed on every scenario. Within an hour, they had created a playground, a safe space for their team to struggle and potentially fail without harming their stakeholders or their business. With the boundaries clearly defined, John's team didn't require optimism from above. Hopeful energy radiated from within. This thinking rippled across Nike's design community and sparked leaders such as Casey Lenner, Senior Director of Global Design Operations, to introduce the risk and iterate performance goal that encouraged each design operations director to identify something they would take a risk with and then iterate solutions throughout the year. Casey said, "To me, it's not about failing. It's about prototyping. If someone on my team has an idea they want to pursue, I tell them to go for it and I'll provide support if they need it. If it doesn't work, we can still learn and evolve from it." This risk and iterate effort legitimized the possibility of failure and created safety for designers to tackle the scary problems. One of her 20 staff members said, "She empowers us to lean into the tension and take risks." Another team member said, "She strikes this amazing balance between giving us the freedom to try things and always having our backs when we need support." In 2012, Casey Leonard's staff secretly nominated her for the Multiplier of the Year award and then cheered and celebrated her as she won. Level the playing field. In any formal organization, the playing field is not exactly level, and certain voices are inherently advantaged. These usually include senior executives, influential thought leaders, critical organizations like product development or sales, and people with deep legacy knowledge. Unless the situation is managed, other voices that are perhaps closest to the real issues can be muffled. Liberators know how to amplify these voices to extract maximum intelligence and give advantage to the ideas and voices on the lower end of the playing field. Mark Dankberg is chairman of the board and CEO of Viasat, Inc., which he co-founded in 1986. Under his leadership, Viasat has consistently been one of America's fastest-growing technology companies and was named 3 times in the Inc. 500 list of fastest-growing private companies. Mark presides over a large firm with $1.4 billion in annual revenue and over 4,000 employees, but he ensures the inherent hierarchy doesn't block the best ideas from being heard and rising up. Mark operates with the assumption that if you hire really good people, you don't need to be limited by org charts. If someone on the engineering side of the business thinks something is wrong in another area, it is expected that they will speak up and make sure the company does the right thing. At Viasat, a VP or CEO can be challenged by a first-year engineer right out of college. In fact, junior staff are expected to speak up. And when they do, they are heard. Mark reflected, wisdom doesn't just come from the top. It comes from all across the organization. But as a leader, you have to do more than just not discourage it. You need to actively encourage people to speak up. The leader has to ask questions and invite the most junior people to express their ideas. Kevin is Viasat's general counsel, who began working with Mark when he was a young attorney in an outside law firm. Kevin said, "The funny thing is, regardless of my level, Mark has always treated me the same. With Mark, it's about good thinking and providing your well-thought-out point of view. Titles don't bring you more respect. It's about what you're contributing. When I was younger, Mark would always listen to my ideas." Kevin recalls one day when he was new to Viasat and working on a holiday. He accompanied his boss into Mark's office to share an opinion on a business matter. The debate that ensued went on for 3 hours. Kevin was deeply impressed that the opinion of a junior attorney mattered to the CEO and has remained emboldened by this experience years later. When Viasat's commercial mobility business was experiencing rapid growth, the company assembled a team comprising of both veteran leaders and junior managers to formulate a growth plan. As the team began making decisions about roles, one veteran manager casually said, "I'll talk to James about the role and see what he thinks." The newer manager looked surprised that a senior executive would consult with a junior employee. "Talk to him? Don't we just decide what he's going to do? It's not a democracy." When he heard about this, Mark clarified, "Well, Viasat kind of is a democracy. We don't just tell people what their jobs are. We give people choice about what they work on, as long as they perform at the level their coworkers expect." Liberators begin by creating space, but they do more than create space for others to contribute. They also expect extraordinary work in return. Practice number 2, demand people's best work. Henry Kissinger, U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon, was a demanding diplomat, but he also had some masterful multiplier moments. According to one story, his chief of staff once handed in a report he had written on an aspect of foreign policy. When Kissinger received the report, he asked simply, "Is this your best work?" The chief thought for a moment and, worried that his boss would think the report wasn't good enough, responded, "Mr. Kissinger, I think I can do better." So Kissinger gave back the report. 2 weeks later, the chief turned in the revised report. Kissinger kept it for a week and then sent it back with a note that said, "Are you sure this is your best work?" Realizing that something must have been missing, the chief once again rewrote the report. This time, when he handed the report to his boss, he said, "Mr. Kissinger, this is my best work." Upon hearing this, Kissinger replied, "Then this time I will read your report." Here are a few ways that liberators demand the best from those they work with. Defend the standard. Larry Gelwicks, the head coach of Highland Rugby, stood at the center of a huddle of rugby players at the side of the field for the team's first game debrief of the season. Larry asked one question. Did you give your best? One player enthusiastically spoke up. Well, we won, didn't we? Not unkindly, Larry said, "That's not the question I asked." Another player jumped in. "We just dominated that team. We won 64-20. What more could you ask for?" Larry said, "When you came for tryouts, I said I expected your best. That means your best thinking out there as well as your best physical effort. Is that what you gave today?" One player described one game played on the island of Tonga where he could answer yes to Larry's question. He said, "I had a painful shoulder contusion after a devastating tackle on my opponent. I was ready to quit, ready to let my team down. I couldn't lift my arm, and the pain was excruciating. I remember I began to chant the haka, a traditional Maori war chant, in my head. I remember looking over at the sunset through the palm trees. At that very moment, the game seemed to stop, and I had a choice. A voice told me that I needed to keep going and do my best, not only for myself, but for who I am, and most importantly for the team, for my brothers. The voice was the recollection of countless practices and games when Coach Gelwicks simply asked, 'Is that your best?' I finished that game with 2 tries, each equivalent to a touchdown, becoming the first high school American to score in Tonga. As a manager, you know when someone is below his or her usual performance. What is harder to know is whether people are giving everything they have. Asking whether people are offering their best gives them an opportunity to push themselves beyond previous limits. It is a key reason why people report that multipliers get more than 100% intelligence out of them. Distinguish best work from outcomes. Requiring people's best work is different than insisting on desired outcomes. Stress is created when people are expected to produce outcomes that are beyond their control. But they feel a positive pressure when they're held to their best work. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, innovator of green power generators globally, and a renowned scientist himself, has mastered this distinction in his company. K.R. said, "If you want your organization to take risks, you have to separate the experiment from the outcome. I have zero tolerance if someone does not run the experiment. But I don't hold them accountable for the outcome of the experiment. I only hold them accountable to execute." This is one of Bloom Energy's secrets for innovating across complex integrated technologies. Hayer understands the distinction between pressure and stress. He cites the famous image of William Tell shooting an apple off his son's head. In this scenario, William Tell feels pressure. His son feels stress. K.R. keeps the pressure on his team to act, but he doesn't create stress by holding them accountable for outcomes beyond their control. Practice number 3, generate rapid learning cycles. In studying multipliers, I have often wondered, how smart do you have to be a multiplier? The answer from Bill Campbell, former chairman and CEO of Intuit, was perfect. You have to be smart enough to learn. Perhaps most important, liberators give people permission to make mistakes and the obligation to learn from them. Admit and share mistakes. When Lutz Ziab took over as general manager of the education business at Microsoft in 2003, it was falling short of its goals for revenue and reach. Lutz needed to make progress fast and could have easily created a stressful environment around him. But he also needed the organization to be creative and take risks if they were to catch up in the market. It's a classic management dilemma. If you take the obvious path, the climate becomes tense and your people may become risk-averse. But if you lessen the pressure by softening the goals, then your organization becomes complacent. Lutz did neither. Instead, he created an environment that was equal parts pressure and learning. Lutz never backed down from the natural pressure for the business to perform, but he made it safe for people to take risks and make mistakes. He did this by how he responded to both his mistakes and the mistakes of others. Lutz does not hide his own mistakes or divert them to his staff. He confesses them shamelessly. He loves to tell stories, and his favorites are about his mistakes. When he launched an unsuccessful product, he talked about it openly and what he learned from it. One member of his management team said, "He brings an intellectual curiosity for why things didn't work out." By taking his mistakes public, he made it safe for others to take risks and fail. Insist on learning from mistakes. Lutz creates room for other people to make mistakes. When Chris Peary, the general manager for sales and marketing working for Lutz, was newly promoted to lead sales for Microsoft Learning, he tried a risky promotion. Unfortunately, it didn't work. But instead of rationalizing the mistake, he went to Lutz, admitted the misstep, diagnosed it, and then tried something different. Chris said, "With Lutz, you get to make mistakes, but you're expected to learn fast. With Lutz, it's okay to fail. You just can't make the same mistake twice." Lutz loves feedback. He isn't just open to it, he insists on it. A direct report of his recalled a time he had to give Lutz some tough love about a critical project Lutz was particularly excited about. As such, he had been dominating the discussion and had taken over. Lutz's direct report scheduled a one-on-one, sat down in Lutz's office, and delivered the feedback. "Lutz, you are sucking the oxygen out of the room. No one else has any room to breathe. You need to back off." How do you think Lutz responded? How would you have responded if one of your people suggested you were a domineering oxygen hog? Lutz's curiosity was triggered, and his response was simple. He asked, "What does it look like? Who did it impact? How do I avoid doing it again?" After taking the time to understand his mistake, he asked his direct report, "Will you tell me if I do this again?" His final comment to his direct report was, "I wish you would have told me sooner." He really meant it. Lutz achieved the climate he wanted, even amidst a stressful learning environment, by generating rapid learning cycles. As Chris Peary said, Lutz creates an environment where good things happen. Even in times of immense external pressure, Lutz created a climate that drew out people's best thinking and work, and he maintained a creative intensity. Tyrants and liberators both expect mistakes. Tyrants stand ready to pounce on people who make them. Liberators stand ready to learn as much from the mistake as possible. The highest quality of thinking cannot emerge without learning. Learning can't happen without mistakes. Liberators get the best thinking from people by creating a rapid cycle between thinking, learning, and making and recovering from mistakes in order to generate the best ideas and create an agile organization. As K.R. Sridhar explained, "We iterate fast so we can bring cycle time down. The key to this rapid iteration is creating an environment where people can bring up risks and deal with mistakes sooner." A.G. Laffley, former CEO at Procter & Gamble, said, "You want your people to fail early, fast, and cheap, and then learn from it." Diminishers don't generate these cycles. They might request, if not demand, people's best thinking, but they fail to establish the environment where ideas are easily expressed and developed to full maturity and efficacy. The diminisher's approach to environment. Diminishers haven't developed this smooth duality of comfort and pressure. Instead, They jerk the organization around as they swing between two modes. One, militant insistence on their ideas, and two, passive indifference to the ideas and work of others. Timothy Wilson is an award-winning Hollywood property master. He and his team set the scene and create context for a movie, and he has worked on some of the biggest and most successful films. He's a creative genius, but he comes at a high cost. Why? Because so few people are willing to work for him twice. One of his staff said, "I'd take any job before working with him." Signing up to work with Timothy means working in fear and stress with little enjoyment. Those who do work for him say, "You don't want to come back to work the next day." From the moment Timothy steps onto the set, the mood changes. People brace for his criticism. As Jeremy sees Timothy walk over to one of the props that he had been working on for the last 2 days, Jeremy wonders which of the usual insults it will be. Or will he perhaps deliver a rare compliment? Timothy inspects the prop and delivers his signature critique loudly and to the whole group. "This looks like a prop for a B-movie." And then there's the random things that set him off. If the prop cart isn't organized correctly, he goes crazy. One day he got so tense that he argued with the director of photography and threw his walkie-talkie at him. The set went from tense to tenser as people prepared to duck and cover. Some leaders create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. Timothy created a tense environment by dominating the space, creating anxiety, and judging others in a way that had a stifling effect on people's thinking and output. Dominate the space. Tyrants are like a gas that expands and consumes all the available space. They dominate meetings and hog all the airtime. They leave little room for anyone else and often suffocate other people's intelligence in the process. They do this by voicing strong opinions, overexpressing their ideas, and trying to maintain control. Garth Yamamoto, chief marketing officer at a consumer products company, uses up almost every cubic inch of space in the room. He jumps in and interrupts people's presentations. He expresses very strong and extreme opinions, and either spends his time micromanaging or is noticeably absent. People warn newcomers in his division. "The art of being successful around here is figuring out Garth." One member of his group said, "I think I'm atrophying here. I'm probably giving him about 50%. That person has since left the organization and is thriving in another company. Create anxiety. The hallmark of a tyrant is their temperamental and unpredictable behavior. People don't know what will set them off, but it is almost certain that the mood will change when they are around. Tyrants impose an anxiety tax wherever they go, because a percentage of people's mental energy is consumed trying to avoid upsetting the tyrant. Just think of the wasted productivity on the set with Timothy. Instead of using their full energy making A-movie props, Timothy's team worries about the next thing that Timothy is going to say or do, or for that matter, throw. Judge others. Tyrants centralize their power and play judge, jury, and executioner. In sharp contrast to the rapid learning cycles of the liberator, tyrants create cycles of criticism, judgment, and retreat. Like the presenters scurrying to adjust their presentation for Jenna Healy, the telecommunications sales leader who resembled Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada, people retreat to a safe position where their ideas won't be criticized or exposed. The Japanese have a saying for this, "Deru kuwai wa utareru," which translates as, "The stake that sticks out gets hammered down." When leaders play the role of the tyrant, they suppress people's thinking and capability. People restrain themselves and work cautiously, only bringing up safe ideas that the leader is likely to agree with. This is why diminishers are costly to organizations. Under the influence of a diminisher, The organization pays full price for a resource, but only receives about 50% of its value. Diminishers believe that pressure increases performance. They demand people's best thinking, but they don't get it. They haven't created an environment where people feel safe to truly express themselves and their ideas. An unsafe environment yields only the safest ideas. On the other hand, multipliers know that people are intelligent and will figure it out. Because they engage people's natural intelligence, people offer them back their full brain power. Because people have a foundation of safety and comfort, they're free to offer their boldest ideas, not just the safe ideas that will keep them out of the wrath of the tyrant. The environment of learning has enabled them to take risks and quickly and inexpensively recover from them. There is an assumption that underlies the practices of a liberator. People's best thinking must be given, not taken. A manager may be able to insist on certain levels of productivity and output, but someone's full effort, including their truly discretionary effort, must be given voluntarily. This changes the leader's role profoundly. Instead of demanding the best work directly, they create an environment where it not only can be offered, but where it is deeply needed. Because the environment naturally requires it, a person freely bestows their best thinking and work. Becoming a liberator. Remember that the path of least resistance is often the path of the diminisher. As Michael said, it's not like it isn't tempting to be tyrannical when you can. Becoming a liberator requires long-term commitment. Here are a few starting points. The starting block. Experiment number one, play fewer chips. If you want to create more room for others to contribute, and especially if you are prone to dominating discussions, you might consider a good game of poker chips. Matthew is a smart, articulate leader. However, he often found himself frustrated and running out ahead of his organization, struggling to bring a cross-functional team along with him and his ideas. He was also struggling to be heard. He had great ideas, but he was simply talking too much and taking up too much space in team meetings. I was working with him to prepare a critical leadership forum for his division. He was eagerly awaiting the opportunity to share his views about the strategy for advancing the business to the next level. Instead of encouraging him, I gave him a challenge. I gave him 5 poker chips, each worth a number of seconds of talk time. One was worth 120 seconds, the next 3 worth 90 seconds, and one was worth just 30 seconds. I suggested he limit his contribution in the meeting to 5 comments, represented by each of the chips. He could spend them whenever he wished, but he only had 5. After the initial shock and bemusement, wondering how he could possibly convey all his ideas in 5 comments, he accepted the challenge. I watched as he carefully restrained himself, filtering his thoughts for only the most essential, and looking for the right moment to insert his ideas. He played his chips deftly and achieved 2 important outcomes. 1, he created abundant space for others. Instead of being Matthew's strategy session, it became a forum for a diverse group to voice ideas and co-create the strategy. And 2, Matthew increased his own credibility and presence as a leader. By exercising some leadership restraint, everyone was heard more, including Matthew as the leader. Try giving yourself a budget of poker chips for a meeting. Maybe it is 5, maybe it is just 1 or 2. Use them wisely and leave the rest of the space for others to contribute. Experiment number 2, label your opinions. As you know, formal organizations can create a strong deference to the opinions and thinking of the leader. One executive described his first week as a newly appointed president of a large company. People came at him from all directions to ask him their pent-up questions. He was new and wanted to be helpful, so he would offer a casual opinion. To his amazement, weeks later, he found that his opinions had become a set of disjointed policies. As he unraveled the mess, he learned to carefully label the difference between a random musing, an opinion, and a policy decision. Try the practice used by Michael Chang in his shift to Liberator. Divide your views into soft opinions and hard opinions. Soft opinions are those where you have a perspective to offer and ideas for someone else to consider. Hard opinions are where you have a clear and potentially emphatic point of view. By doing this, you can create space for others to comfortably disagree with your soft opinions and establish their own views. Reserve hard opinions for when they really matter. Experiment number 3. Talk up your mistakes. There's no easier way to invite experimentation and learning than to share stories about your own mistakes. Your acknowledgement as a leader of your mistakes will give others permission to experience failure and go on to learn and recover with dignity and increased capability. Great parents do this with their children. They understand that their children are liberated when they know their parents are human and make mistakes just as they do. They especially appreciate knowing that their parents learned from their blunders and recovered. When we help people see a path to recovery, we spawn a learning cycle. As you share your mistakes, try these two approaches. Number 1, get personal. Let people know about mistakes you have made and what you've learned from them. Let them know how you have incorporated this learning into your decisions and current leadership practices. For example, as a manager of a consulting group, you might share with your team the time you led a project that failed and how you dealt with the irate customer. You can focus on what the experience taught you and how it shaped your current approach to project management. Number 2. Go public. Instead of talking about mistakes behind closed doors or just one-on-one, bring them out into the open where the person making a mistake can clear the air and where everyone can learn. Try making it a part of your management ritual. As a corporate manager, I would often take this practice to the extreme. A regular feature in my staff meetings was screw up of the week. If any member of my management team, including myself, had an embarrassing blunder, this was the time to go public, have a good laugh, and then move on. This simple gesture sent a message to the team. Mistakes are an essential part of progress. Experiment number 4, make space for mistakes. Define the space for experimentation in your team's work by clarifying the area where it's okay to fail versus when failure isn't an option. This delineation acts like a ship's waterline, as described by management author Jim Collins. Above the waterline, people can experiment and take risks and still recover. However, mistakes below the waterline are like cannonballs that may cause catastrophic failure and sink the ship. Creating a clear waterline for your team will give them confidence to experiment and take bolder action, but will signal to them to be extra diligent where the stakes are high. This distinction will also signal to you when you can stand back and when you need to jump in and rescue. Each of the steps outlined previously is a simple starting point, but these practices, if done consistently over time, can allow a leader to become a powerful force for liberating the intelligence from within an organization. Free to think. When people operate under stress, they shut down. With enough stress, they eventually rebel, often overthrowing their despotic leaders. To build organizations where people can think and do their best work, We need to do more than rid our organizations of tyrants and oppressive dictators. We need leaders who serve as liberators, giving people space to think and learn while applying enough pressure to demand their best work. Multipliers liberate people from the intimidation of hierarchical organizations and the domination of tyrannical leaders. Multipliers don't tell people what to think. They tell them what to think about. They define a challenge that invites each person's best thinking and generates collective will. They create an environment where every brain is utilized and every voice is heard. Instead of rebellion, they create a movement. Chapter 3 Summary: The Tyrant versus the Liberator. Tyrants create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. As a result, people hold back, bring up safe ideas that the leader agrees with, and work cautiously. Liberators create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. As a result, people offer their best and boldest thinking and give their best effort. The three practices of the liberator. Number one, create space. Release others by restraining yourself. Shift the ratio of listening to talking. Define a space for discovery. Level the playing field. Number two, demand best work. Defend the standard. Distinguish best work from outcomes. Number three, generate rapid learning cycles. Admit and share mistakes. Insist on learning from mistakes. Becoming a liberator. Experiment number one, play fewer chips. Experiment number two, label your opinions. Experiment number three, talk up your mistakes. Experiment number four, make space for mistakes. Leveraging resources. Tyrants. What they do? They create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. And what do they get? They get people who hold back but appear to be engaged on the surface. They get safe ideas the leader already agrees with. They get people who work cautiously, avoid taking risks, and find excuses for any mistakes they make. Liberators. What they do? They create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. And what do they get? They get people who offer their best thinking and really engage their full brain power. They get the best and boldest ideas. They get people who give their full effort and will go out on a limb and learn quickly from any mistakes. Unexpected findings. Number one, the path of least resistance is often the path of tyranny. Because many organizations are skewed, a leader can be above average in an organization and still operate as a tyrant. Number two, liberators maintain a duality of giving people permission to think while also creating an obligation for them to do their best work. Number three, multipliers are intense. Leaders who can discern and create the difference between a tense and an intense climate can access significantly more brain power from their organizations. Chapter 4, The Challenger. The number one difference between a Nobel Prize winner and others is not IQ or work ethic, but that they ask bigger questions. Peter Drucker. Matt McCauley took the reins of Gymboree in 2006, a $790 million children's retailer headquartered in San Francisco, at the age of 33, after coming through the ranks of planning and inventory management. This made Matt not only the youngest CEO to head Gymboree in its 30-year history, but also the youngest CEO of a company in Wall Street's Russell 2000 Index. McCauley used his youth to keep him open to the ideas of others. Macaulay said, "I love to riff and bounce ideas off of people. Regardless of what their function is, Gymboree employees are all talented, bright people." Matt had been a pole vaulter in college. He set one bar at 17 feet 6 inches, which is what he knew he could clear, but always kept a second bar set at 20 feet, the world record at the time, to remind himself of what was possible. Matt took this same approach at work, raising the bar. When Matt took over as president, he had the benefit of a recently rejuvenated product line, as well as the challenge of some sloppy business operations. He saw an opportunity not only to grow sales, but to vastly increase net income per share, which at the time stood at 69 cents per share. Using his deep knowledge of operations and inventory optimization, he estimated the upside opportunity, then went to the board and told them he believed the company could achieve $1 per share. The board members laughed, but Matt remained convinced of the possibility. As Matt met with his management team, he explained his rationale for the growth opportunity in both sales and earnings per share. He took them through the calculations for sales and expense optimizations that he had been studying for the last 5 years and asked if they could indeed be achieved. He then threw out Mission Impossible, a net income of $1 a share. He asked each member of his management team this question: what would be your Mission Impossible? As the management team caught the enthusiasm of this high bar approach, they began to ask the entire organization to do the same. Soon every person inside this 9,500-person organization had a Mission Impossible goal, a crazy aspiration. It appeared that being asked to identify their personal Mission Impossible ignited the charge to make it possible. Clearing the bar. A year later, Matt announced to the board, to Wall Street, and to every employee in Gymboree that they had achieved not just the Mission Impossible goal of $1, but had reached $1.19 per share, a 72% improvement over the previous fiscal year. Fueled by this accomplishment, what did Matt do next? He set the bar higher and suggested to the board that they could achieve $2 per share. This time, the board thought it was outrageous, but he turned to his organization for support, sharing his Mission Impossible task and once again asking every person to create their personal Mission Impossible needed to achieve $2 per share. In fiscal year 2007, they delivered $2.15 per share, an 80% improvement. Again, Matt went to the board to suggest $3 per share. 1 year later, he announced $2.67 per share. And 2 years later, in 2008, an incredible $3.21 per share. That is more than 50% increase in earnings per share year over year and an almost fivefold increase in 4 years. Mission Impossible. This young challenger CEO used his deep knowledge of the business to see both an opportunity and a path for achieving unheard of levels of business performance. He articulated this opportunity and laid down the challenge for the organization. He then asked each person to join him in attempting the impossible and to analyze how they might achieve it. By setting the bar high, he gave people permission to rethink the business. By asking them to create their personal Mission Impossible, he allowed them to embrace and step into the challenge themselves. And by acknowledging the impossible nature of the mission, he gave people permission to try without fear of failure. Matt got more out of people than they knew they had to give, not because he convinced them that a goal was possible, but because he invited them to explore the impossible, that uncertain, uncomfortable place that makes us stretch both our imagination and our capabilities. Consider another executive's approach to setting direction. the expert. Richard Palmer founded SMT Systems in the mid-1990s in the United Kingdom to build systems and tools for business process reengineering. Started as Richard's brand